Welcome to People Power and Politics, our talk, riveting interviews, community updates, in-depth analysis. That's People Power and Politics. We tell it to you as it is. No holds barred. You are the people. You have the power. We bring you the politics. To listen to our show, be a guest, or to advertise, visit www.pppradio.nyc. That's www.pppradio.nyc.
A very warm welcome to everyone. We are joined by a very special guest, Kevin Kenny, who is a Glassman Professor of History, Director of Glassman Iron House at New York University, and President of the Immigration and Ethnic History Society. Mr. Kenny came to the United States as an immigrant in the 1980s, and he's also the author of The Problem of Immigration in a Slaveholding Republic, Policy and Mobility in the 19th Century United States. This book offers valuable insights into historical immigration dynamics within the context of a slaveholding society. In this interview, we look at the historical perspective and comparisons between historical immigration issues and contemporary ones. Welcome. Good to have you here with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So tell us, what inspired you to write this book, and can you provide an overview of the central themes and arguments in The Problem of Immigration in a Slaveholding Republic?
So I was inspired to write this book. I started 10 years ago. It just came out last year. And I was inspired to write it when I realized I did not know the answer to a fundamental question. So it was a good starting point. So through much of my career as a historian, I wrote what we call social history, the history of ordinary people struggling to make a new life for themselves as immigrants, sometimes engaged in social or political protest. That was my focus. We sometimes call that history from the bottom up, history from below. It's the type of history I was trained to do. I never asked who had authority over immigration. It just wasn't my question. That's a legal and constitutional question.
Was that the fundamental question you asked yourself?
So the fundamental question was, who has authority over immigration and human mobility in the United States? Because if you think about it, that's a pretty extraordinary claim for one person to be able to make to control the movement of another person, right?
It is.
So in a country like the United States, which is known as a nation of immigrants, it was also a nation of enslaved people, a nation of westward imperial expansion, but it was a nation of immigrants in the sense that more people came here to this country than from any place else, mm-hmm. and from a greater variety than ever in the history of the world. There are 50 million foreign-born people in the United States today. So in a country of that kind, which also happens to have a famous written constitution, which provides the rules for how the society is meant to run, you would think the answer would be easy. You go to the constitution and that'll answer the question, who has authority over immigration? Biggest surprise to me was that the constitution is silent on immigration. It does not say anything about who has the power to control the admission, the exclusion, or the removal of foreign-born people. It does have one provision that is very relevant to immigration, and that is it provides Congress with the power to craft a naturalization policy. Now, that pertains to people after they get here. So if you're foreign-born, like me, you come to the country, you can become a citizen. There are rules for that. They were laid down almost straight away, starting in 1790, remarkably liberal by the standards of the time. Anybody who came here, there's going to be a caveat, right? But anybody who came here, who lived for 2 years, then it was increased to five, which it is today, and showed proof of good character and took an oath, could become a citizen of the United States. They could cast off their old allegiance, something that was impossible, for example, under British law. British law, once a subject, always a subject. In America, you can become a new person. But what's the catch? You have to be a free white person. It's written into the law. Not until 1870 were people of African origin or descent permitted to naturalize as citizens. And even really shockingly, when you first encounter it, Asian immigrants did not receive the right to naturalize as U.S. citizens until the 1940s and 1950s. Okay, so that's all the Constitution says about immigration per se. I said, well, wow, that's a mystery. And then I began to realize that Congress and the national government were doing nothing in this domain. The president made some treaties with China, with Britain. But when it comes to what we conventionally understand as immigration, people arriving into the country from the outside, Congress did nothing on that until the 1860s and 1870s, almost a full century into the history of the Republic. And that's not a coincidence, because that's the period of Civil War and Reconstruction. It's only during the period of Civil War and Reconstruction that a newly empowered federal state takes on this big topic of regulating immigration. Before that, for almost 100 years, immigration into the country by foreigners and the movement of free black people within the states and between the states was controlled locally. It was controlled under what's called the police power of the states. So now it began to, you know, the dots began to connect. And I began to realize that at the heart of immigration history is the institution of slavery. Because my argument in the book is that if you look at the transition from local to state to federal control over immigration, which emerged in the 19th century, that the single most important factor is the existence, abolition, and legacies of slavery. So my book tells that story the whole way through. Slavery is the key question.
So I think you answered part of this question, but I'm still going to ask it. What are some of the key immigration policies and practices discussed in the book, and how did they intersect with the institution of slavery?
Yes, and that follows really from the introductory comments I gave there. Mm-hmm. So for about 100 years, the states made their own policies on migration and on citizenship, because there's national citizenship and there's local citizenship, right? So the states controlled their own communities, their own civil and political membership, and their own borders, right? So if you were to look for immigration policy before the Civil War, what you'd find is that each state had its own policy regulating mobility. And insofar as those policies affected foreigners, that's the immigration policy of the United States, with an emphasis on states in the plural, right? There is no national policy at this time, nor could there have been one, is my argument, because let's take a state like Massachusetts or New York. Mm-hmm. Well, they have laws on the books that are taxing foreign passengers who are suspected of either being paupers, poor, vulnerable, indigent people, mentally, physically disabled. They're either already in that state or they're likely to become a public charge. You know that phrase, LPC, likely to become a public charge? Mm-hmm. That goes way back in history before it's federalized. So New York and Massachusetts, to take two examples, have these laws whereby a tax is placed on the passengers, or the ship captain has to post a bond. You might be said, look, you've got vulnerable passengers there. You're going to post a bond for $300. If one of those passengers becomes a public charge, then you're going to have to pay that bond, right? So there's a set of policies. But states in especially the Midwest, which the old Northwest as it was known then, have the same policies in place to prevent and prohibit free black people from entering their territory. So many of the states, Ohio, Illinois, the territories in today's Midwest, have exactly the same mechanism, taxes and bonds, to deter the entry of free black people onto their soil. Now, these were free soil states and territories. They were anti-slavery. But the reason they were anti-slavery was not out of humanitarian concern for black people. They didn't want black people of any kind on their territory. Third element of this, and this is really shocking. If you came to the port of South Carolina, Charleston, South Carolina, in the antebellum period, and you were a free black sailor coming from England or the Caribbean or from another state in the Union, from Massachusetts, The law said that you had to be confined on your vessel or in the county jail for the duration of your stay, because the presence of a free black person contradicts the logic of slavery. The logic of slavery is that the natural condition of people of African origin or descent is enslavement. So the term moral contagion is used to describe the arrival of free black people, just like public health contagion in the Northeast for Irish paupers arriving during the famine. Now, here's the constitutional question. These are all state and local laws. The Supreme Court looks at them and says, do the states have the right to do that? Or should immigration be a federal matter? And before the Civil War, the courts just keep backing away from that because they acknowledge that the states have a form of power that we call police power, local police power, to run their own internal affairs. And so before the Civil War, you just have a whole messy collection of laws on migration. And if the courts were to intervene and say, wait a second, New York can't regulate Irish paupers that way because immigration is a federal matter under the Commerce Clause, well, all of the southern states are looking at this. And so you can't give power of that kind over migration and mobility to the national government because they'll use it to undermine the institution of slavery.
Okay, so looking at the impact on society, how did immigration during the period of slavery impact social dynamics, labor systems, and economic structures within the United States?
So during the period of slavery, relatively few immigrants were coming into the South because you have an enslaved captive workforce. Heavy immigration was coming into the Northeast and the Midwest. So if you were to look at the middle of the 19th century, astonishingly, you would find that 45%, almost half of all the immigrants coming into the United States in the 1840s were Irish. Ireland is a small little country geographically and by population, but the Irish are coming in huge numbers. And economically, they're very important because they build the infrastructure of the Industrial Revolution and of American cities. They dig and break and build and carry. They do hard physical labor. Women serve as domestics in middle-class households. So the point I want to make here is people didn't like the Irish. They looked down on the Irish. There was plenty of anti-Catholic prejudice. They made fun of the Irish. They didn't like their poverty, their manners, their religion, their morals. But nobody was trying to keep them out of the country. There was no numerical restriction on the Irish. There's no numerical restriction on white European immigrants, really, until the 1880s, 1890s. And then that culminates in the immigration restriction laws of the 1920s. So we have to be a little bit careful. The Irish did encounter considerable prejudice and bigotry and nastiness, but there wasn't a restriction movement trying to keep them out because the economy depended on them.
So looking against the background of everything you spoke about, what ethical dilemmas or moral questions do you think, you know, from the historical immigration policies within a slaveholding society, and how might they compare to contemporary ethical debates surrounding immigration, looking at what's happening right now?
Yeah, the ethical dimension is a huge question. And, you know, as historians, we try and make sense of the past and judge it historically. Of course, there's an ethical and moral dimension to it. In the 19th century, when states controlled their own local citizenship policies, their own community membership, and they controlled their borders, movement within their borders and across their borders, I would say that community control was really, really pervasive. The states decided who belonged to their community. And if you were a free black person in the South, they said you can't even be a citizen of the country. So if you're a free black person in Massachusetts, you were a citizen of Massachusetts. And by extension, theoretically at least, a citizen of the United States. If you were living in South Carolina, South Carolina denied the very possibility that you could be a citizen, right? So there's a harshness, to say the least, to all of these methods of immigration, of control of movement by people, mm-hmm. regardless of whether they're native-born or foreign-born. The transfer of power to the federal government during Civil War and Reconstruction, it just tilted the balance away from the states to the national government. That did an awful lot of good in so many respects, right? It curbed the worst abuses of the states. It introduced the 14th Amendment, guaranteeing birthright citizenship if you're born on the soil, allowing naturalization if you're not born on the soil. In so many ways, it sets the constitutional balance of power, tilting it away from the worst abuses of the states and introducing federally protected rights, civil rights, as we call them today. However, the newly expanded federal state that emerged during Reconstruction, that was capable of helping in particular formerly enslaved people that way, was also capable of restricting immigration much more successfully than any state could do. So when the Supreme Court steps in the 1870s and invalidates state immigration measures, it can do it unequivocally once slavery is gone. It says, wait a second, states can't control national borders. That's a federal matter. Well, the states take a look at that, and local officials in Massachusetts and New York, the two main receiving ports in the Northeast, say, well, wait a second, if you're taking that power away from us, who's going to pay for the upkeep of immigrants? So you get a national immigration law passed in 1882, the first general immigration act in American history, borrows directly from the old state measures, but it federalizes them, and it does so in two ways. It imposes a head tax of 50 cents on every immigrant entering the country. That's what the states were doing. And it has an LPC clause, likely to become a public charge. So the federal government is turning away a small number, but it wasn't small to the people involved, of vulnerable people. Okay, that's in the Northeast. In the West, anti-Chinese restrictionists take a look at this transfer over to federal power, and they say, okay, well, look, our state measures in California to exclude Chinese people, they're just going to be overturned by the courts. Why don't you do it? So they pressure Congress to pass a second piece of legislation in 1882, which is the Chinese Exclusion Act. So two key pieces of law, the General Immigration Act for everybody, the Chinese Exclusion Act targeting Chinese laborers, using techniques that have been deployed against free black people in the South in the antebellum period. You have to carry papers, you have to register, you can be deported if you don't do so. Now, your question really is, how do some of those questions translate into today? I'd cite one scholar whose work I admire, Carlo McCanders, who says that the treatment, especially of undocumented immigrants, of whom there are 12 million or so, 11 or 12 in the United States, in her mind, as a scholar of the African-American past, produces what she calls a system of tiered personhood, a hierarchy of people that she says is reminiscent of Jim Crow.
I was thinking some of the same things are still happening today. So what insights, perspectives, or biases can readers glean from your analysis of immigration within a slaveholding society?
So this is a book about the basis on which some people claim to control the mobility of other people. Right? If you really step back from what I'm doing, that's the key question. Who has authority to do that? Because I find that, you know, if you step back from that, that's an extraordinary claim. What gives certain people the right to control the movement of other people? So in that sense, my book is about, it's about law. It's not really about laws translated into policy. And then that leads to, say, the expansion of the administrative bureaucracy of the government. It's one step prior to that. What I'm looking at is the logic of race, the logic of sovereignty that underlies these claims in the 19th century that some people can control the movement of others. That plays out through the history of slavery, through most of the book, and then it results ultimately in national immigration control once slavery is over. And the claim on which federal immigration authority rests is really extraordinary, because in my mind, it's extra constitutional. You don't have you can't find text and words in the Constitution to justify this claim. What happens in a famous court case in 1889, known as the Chinese Exclusion Case, is the court takes a look at this and says, well, wait a second. The power to control national borders is inherent in national sovereignty. That's what nations do. You can't be an independent nation unless you control your own borders. So that is what I see as an extra constitutional claim. That claim to sovereignty over the national territory is articulated at a time when there are literally hundreds of semi-autonomous tribes and nations living on the same soil that the United States is now claiming to have exclusive jurisdiction over. There are literally hundreds of Native American tribes and nations whose existence rests on their own sovereign claims. And so you see that this intersects with the other huge question in the 19th century, which is federal power over indigenous people.
So based on the insights provided by your analysis, what policy recommendations or approaches could be drawn to address current immigration challenges, taking into account historical precedents?
So my book is about what we call immigration federalism. In a federal republic, power is divided between the center and the localities. And there's always a debate over who controls what and on what basis. When it comes to immigration, I think the picture is clear, though it's right now but the Supreme Court is looking at this. Mm-hmm. But the picture is clear. Since the late 19th century, the federal government has controlled national borders. That claim has some tainted origins. I just gave them to you in Chinese exclusion, right?
Yes.
But the claim is that an independent nation, as an attribute of its existence, must control its borders. And that claim has gone unchallenged until very recently. There is another sense of immigration. Once immigrants have entered the country, that's up to the national government, but once they've entered the country, then it's up to local jurisdictions, subnational jurisdictions like cities and states, to decide how they will treat immigrants. This is what we call immigration federalism. What I see happening is a bifurcation, right? A movement in two directions. Depends on where you live in the country. In certain parts of the country, Chicago, parts of California, New York City, there have been, until recently, measures to assist, integrate immigrants, provide sanctuary. In other parts of the country, it runs in the opposite direction. You've got things like California Proposition 187 in 1994, which tried to deny public benefits to undocumented immigrants and their children, right? That's really the start of it in my mind 30 years ago. The Supreme Court took a look at that and said, well, you can't do that. Immigration is a federal matter. You can't be making law that way. And legal persons have rights under the 14th Amendment. You don't have to be a citizen to have access to fundamental rights of due process and equal protection. So that was tossed out by the courts. People knew it would be. It was a provocation to the federal government. You see something very similar happening in Arizona in 2010 with the SB 1070 law. Mm-hmm. Again, the courts take a look at this, all the racial profiling, the attempt to deter immigration. They uphold some of it. They say, no, you can't do that. You're overreaching as a state. You're intruding on federal power. Justice Scalia, leading conservative justice on the court, in that case, Arizona versus the United States, dissented from the majority. He said the Arizona law is fine And he celebrated the old tradition of state police laws that we've been alluding to in this conversation. So you've got this bifurcation where it depends on where you live in the country, whether local police power, which still exists and always will exist in a federal republic, will that be used to assist immigrants or to monitor and punish immigrants? It all depends on how you define the public good and who's defining the public good. Now, as a historian of the 18th and 19th centuries, I don't always have an epilogue bringing the story up to the present. In fact, I don't even like writing that way, where I'll finish my book, say, in 1890, and then I'll, in a kind of heavy-handed way, hammer the reader over the head and say, oh, by the way, this is what the book is about and why it's relevant. But in this case, it emerged naturally and organically for me to address the ongoing tensions in immigration federalism in the United States.
So how can one get a copy of this book?
It's very easy to find online. It's an inexpensive paperback published by Oxford University Press, and you can buy it, well, as they say, wherever books are sold, perhaps not quite, but it's very easily accessible in online venues. Came out last year and appears to have tapped into an issue that's of great importance to us today.
It certainly has. And before we end our conversation, tell me a little bit about your organization. You're the president of the Immigration and Ethnic History Society.
Yes, indeed. So I'm the president of the main national scholarly organization, an all-volunteer group of immigration historians who get together just because we like the field. We don't take an official position on issues because we're a group of several hundred historians with lots of opinions. Anything I've said today, I'm not saying it on behalf of the society, but it's been one of the great pleasures of my career and indeed of my life to preside over several hundred historians from across the United States who care deeply about these issues. And we are meeting in New Orleans this weekend for our annual conference. And I'm trailing off.
All right. Yeah. So thank you so much, Professor Kenny. This was such a wonderful conversation. And hope to have you back again to talk some more on this topic and more.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed this.
Our pleasure.
People Power and Politics. Hard talk, riveting interviews, community updates, in-depth analysis. That's People Power and Politics. We tell it to you as it is. No holds barred. You are the people. You have the power. We bring you the politics. To listen to our show, be a guest, or to advertise, visit www.pppradio.nyc. That's www.pppradio.nyc.